the context in which his countrymen have begun to use these things, because they have become consumed with pleasure and lust, those things of the world that have caused them to become insensitive to spiritual matters, which ultimately are the only things that really matter, right? They have allowed the use of these things to become their God. They have been saturated by lust and can no longer understand, think correctly, or are not sensitive to the spiritual things that are going on around them. In verse 12, I mean, he makes this clear when he says, "But they do not pay attention to the deeds of the Lord, nor do they consider the work of his hand." Now, I want you to go back to Isaiah chapter 1, verse 3. I want us to remember something that was said at the beginning of Isaiah's writings here. He's pretty harsh on the nation of Israel in verse 3. "An ox knows its owner and a donkey its master's manger, but Israel does not know. My people do not understand." He compared the state of Israel to that of being worse than a beast that God had created. They had become so stupid and so blockheaded and hard of understanding that they could not even remember that it was their God who created them, who made them. Like a donkey and an ox remember the one who feeds them, the one who takes care of them, the one that provides them shelter. Israel had become so enamored with pleasure and with the world that they were numb to the things of God. Their minds no longer meditated on God. They no longer understood him as their creator and their sustainer. Instead, they were consumed with these lusts and passions, and they had begun to act and live worse than the beast of the fields. Those animals, oxen and donkeys, you know, their natural instincts, all the animals of the world, they have these natural instincts that give them an inclination towards correct choices. How many, I kind of grew up around a farm with cattle and those types of things. Now, in Texas, it's a little bit different because you have mesquite trees that get probably about as tall as my hand, maybe a little bit taller. In Georgia, we've got the big oak trees. They're all over the place. You can find them some places here in Georgia, but they're really tall. And in the middle of a pasture, it's just an awesome thing to see this huge oak tree that would fill up this sanctuary. And if you have cows out there on a day like today where it's 100 and something degrees and the sun's just beating down, where are the cows going to go? They're going to find shade. That's right. They're going to go. They're going to get under that tree and they're going to stay there in that shade so that they don't have the sun beating down on them, because there's this natural instinct and they understand, you know what? It's hot. It hurts my back to stand out in this sun. It's a little warm. I think I'm going to get out of here because it's not good for me to stand in the sun, right? This is what a cow does. They'll go and find. So you look at any animal, you look at a dog. If you have a dog that stays in the backyard in the summertime, you know what he's going to do? He's going to find shade. If he can't find it, he's going to dig a hole and make it, isn't he? That's what animals have, this inclination to get out of danger. Hot day like today, 100 and something degrees, the sun beating down. If you go to the beach, what are human beings doing? They're laying out in the sun. Right? Now, if that's your thing, that's fine. I'm not a beach person. I'm just trying to give you an illustration to try to understand what Isaiah is saying about his nation in relationship to their thinking and their understanding of God. Ultimately, what it comes down to is God has given you and me, he's given us the ability to reason and to think and to be able to look and go, you know what? This is probably not a good idea. And if it's not a good idea, then I shouldn't give myself over to it and I shouldn't do it, right? And if a cow has enough sense to say, it's hot, this is not good for me, I'm going to get in the shade. In some ways, when we face those types of situations in our life where we can look at it and go, this is not good, this is not right, I'm not going to participate in it. I'm going to get out of that situation, right? Israel had lost, as a nation, had lost that capacity. All the things that they knew already. God had said to them the things that were right, the things that were wrong, the things that were just in his eyes, and they were neglecting all of those things and giving themselves over. And remember, Isaiah talks about sin as stupidity. It's the way he talks about sin. It's just stupid to do it. And so they are acting dumber than an ox and a donkey. That's the way he has talked about this nation that he loves so much and that he's grieving over. They had lost their inclination to understanding right and wrong and avoiding things that were harmful to them, that were wrong. Ultimately, things that were unrighteous in the eyes of God. And they lost that because they lost their connection with God. They had become consumed with something else. Here's the second principle in your notes. Occupation with the world and the pleasures of the world, those things numb the soul and they lessen our awareness of the spiritual realm and of God's presence and work in our lives. Occupation with the world and its pleasures numb the soul. It numbs the soul, lessens our awareness of the spiritual realm and of God's presence and work in our life. Now let's put this in our context, where we are in America today. For years now, our country has bought into the lie that if I work hard day after day, I can achieve a place and a point in my life where I will never want for anything and possibly would never have to work again a day in my life. Do you realize the concept of retirement is really an American concept? The idea of working to a point in your life and stopping and never having to work again. The American dream of becoming so wealthy that you don't have to work. Have you heard that in your life? I mean, haven't you heard that here? I was taught that growing up. Work hard and there may come a day where you don't ever have to work again. If you apply yourself, you can be anything that you want to be, and you can make as much money in this country. You have the opportunity to make as much money and to gain as much wealth as you can so that you never have to worry about anything else in your life. Well, Matthew 16:26 says what? It's at the top of your notes. What does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and yet loses his soul? And we often call that concept the American dream, right? I think that the American dream is ultimately a spiritual nightmare that has corrupted God's people. It's harmed his church and it's hindered the spiritual work in this country and beyond for decades now. Now, I want you to understand that wealth and pleasure in and of themselves, those things are not bad. They're not bad. But when they take the place of the spiritual in our life, when that becomes the priority instead of the spiritual things of life being the priority, when that happens, a nation will not be able to sustain its wealth. It will not be able to enjoy its pleasure. And ultimately, it will not know blessing. It will not know peace, and it will not know protection. What do we gain if we take the whole world and yet we lose our souls? In verses 13 and 14, God comes and gives an eviction notice to the people of Israel. Therefore, my people, because they have neglected these spiritual things, because they have turned to the ways of the world, they have embraced greed. My people are going to go into exile for their lack of knowledge, and their honorable men are famished, and their multitude is parched with thirst. God's going to send them into exile, and ultimately, their very purpose in the beginning, if you go back to Exodus chapter 6, verse 7, where he begins to lead them out of Egypt, the very purpose for which he established this nation was so that they could know their God. So that they could know who he was, understand his character, and have a relationship with him. And we look at the evidence that Isaiah has put out, it's very clear that they do not know their God. We've talked about in Isaiah the characteristics of justice and righteousness. And we're going to see it again here in this text, that those are key characteristics of God that Isaiah emphasizes all through this book. And what has happened is that the nation of Israel has exchanged justice for violence. They've exchanged righteousness for sin. And in doing that, they've come to a place where they no longer truly know their God, because they don't exhibit His characteristics. They have these facts about God, because remember, the religious system that God gave is still in place there, right? The temple worship, all those things are still in place. They have facts about God. They have commands from God. But what they lack is this relationship, which in this relationship is where they can actually experience God. And experiencing God and having a relationship with Him is what gives life to the facts and the commandments that God has given them. Because that ultimately shows what God is really doing in this world, and that He is present with His people. It's not just having facts about God and knowing that He's given these commandments, but it's understanding who the God is that gave those commandments. Now, they have become unable to even experience the presence of God and to be able to see His work in this world. They are not interested in the things that God is interested in. God's interest lies in justice. It lies in righteousness. It lies in love. That's what God is doing in this world. You know, sometimes it's a good thing if we just slow down for a minute in the midst of all the chaos that's going on around us in our country and around the world. Everything that we see going on, from terrorist attacks to corruption in government, all of these things, if we are able to slow down for just a minute and just pray and ask the Holy Spirit, "Would you show me what God is doing and where God is working in this world? Because things seem so desperate, God. But I want to promise you today, your God is alive and active in this world. He is the same God that He has always been, and His pursuit in this world is the redemption of mankind. He has not stopped that. He continues to do that. He calls us to come alongside Him and do that. And it's not just the redemption of sharing the gospel and leading someone to faith in Christ, helping them understand their position as a sinner before God and their desperate need for forgiveness that only comes through Jesus Christ. That has to be the priority. But the gospel is so much more than that. The gospel redeems not only the soul, the gospel redeems all of humanity and all of the world. And it works in lives in ways that, unless we slow down and look and say, "God, show us where You're working, show us how you're touching and changing lives," unless we pray and ask God to show us that, we often miss it. Because humanity, fallen humanity, and Satan and his demons, they can be very loud in this world. And often our God is very calm, pressing towards eternity. And He hasn't changed. He still desires justice and righteousness and love to prevail in this world. And guess what? It will. And it ultimately does. But because Israel has decided not to pursue these things of God, not to be in a relationship with Him, not to walk with Him through this process of redemptive history, they've decided to join with the world, those loud voices of the world, and to pursue greed and lust and passion. Because of that, God's going to deprive not only the rebels, those that are actively rebelling against Him, but He's going to deprive the honorable man as well. He's going to punish that entire nation, and He's going to take away the basic necessities of life, the things that give them food, because they're going to be famished. Not only are they going to be famished, but they're going to be thirsty. That's in verse 13. Then in verse 14, you have this incredible picture of judgment. Sheol enlarges its throat, opens its mouth without measure, without any end. It opens as wide as it needs to, and it swallows up Jerusalem. Remember, Jerusalem was the crown jewel of the nation of Israel. It was supposed to be the city that represented the presence of God before the world. And now, because of how it has become corrupt and it has fallen, this den of revelry and the jubilant, all those that are praising the things of the world, that Sheol, hell itself, opens up. And like you ever watched a snake swallow its prey? It blows up its throat and unhinges its jaw, wraps around it, and just slowly swallows it. This is what God says is going to happen to the nation of Israel. He's going to give them over to this place of death and destruction and punishment. Isn't that an awesome, ugly picture in verse 14 of what happens to a nation when they turn their back on God? What's the culprit of all of this? What is part of the root cause? How did Israel get into such a state? Well, in verse 15, so the common man will be humbled and the man of importance abased. The eyes of the what? Proud also will be abased. Pride is a huge culprit in what's going on in the nation of Israel. See, pride causes men to pursue greater possessions, to seek out more outlandish pleasures, and to set himself apart among his fellow man so that he looks like someone of more importance. That's what pride does. We want more things so that everyone that sees us knows, wow, that man has got a lot. That person surely has a lot of wealth. Well, not only that, we get to a point where we want them to see us doing more outlandish things and being more extravagant in all that we do. You know, it used to be that, you know, the rule, he who has the biggest toys, when he dies, wins, right? The bigger truck, the bigger boat, the one that catches the biggest fish, guys, right? The one who has the nicest house. It has gone even past that in our society today, because now it's who can show their freedom in the most outlandish way. You think about some of the pop stars that are out there and the things that they're doing, the way that they're dressing, the things that they're doing on stage in front of people, sexual acts in public, showing that they're free to do whatever they want. And it's not just in Hollywood and the movies and in pop culture. It's becoming where it's everywhere that we live now. People are wanting to show that they have the freedom and can be just as free as they want to be to do whatever they want to do, to decide to be whatever they want to be. You're seeing it played out in this whole battle over gender. That no matter what you were born, you can determine what you want to be. And you can live that way, regardless of what it does to anyone else. Pushing these limits, that's pride. Wanting more outlandish gifts, wanting more outlandish freedoms, and pushing that envelope, it's prideful. And ultimately what happens, when you're overcome with pride and lust, and it begins to spread, the entire nation ends up paying for it. Not just you, not just a particular part of society, but the entire nation, all of Israel is paying for this. And they all go to the grave together, both the humble and the proud, the wealthy and the poor. God's going to devour them all. In verse 16, we see two characteristics of God that are mentioned here that actually set him apart. Isaiah doesn't emphasize for us in verse 16 anything about God's power, anything about God's authority. He doesn't need to speak about those things. The threats that God has put out tell us enough about what God is going to do and the power and the authority he has. He's already declared that. Israel knows that. They know that he has this power and authority. He's the one that established them. He's the one that set them up. What they've lost is the relationship because they have moved away from exhibiting the very characteristics of their God. And what Isaiah emphasizes for us here is God's character as a just and righteous being. Look at verse 16, but the Lord of hosts will be exalted in judgment. So through what he's putting down on Israel, the judgment that he's handing down and what he's going to put them through, he's going to be exalted. He's going to be lifted up. He's going to be made known by what he does to his own people. And the holy God will show himself holy in what? Not in his anger, not in his wrath, not in the exercise of his power or his authority, but in his righteousness. When we stand before God, the very thing that's going to humble us is not our power and authority. I want you to think about that. It's not God's power and authority. When you stand before Him, if He stood with power and authority, one could still be defiant against that, couldn't they? Satan was defiant against that, right? When he stood before God. In our hearts, are we not really defiant against God's power and authority when we sin against Him? It's because the thing that's going to humble us when we come face to face with God in the judgment is not His power, it's not His authority. But it's the fact that at that moment, in the judgment, He's going to be exalted. And what's going to exalt Him is that we are going to realize and recognize God's justice and God's righteousness. That's what's going to humble us. That's what should humble us in this life, is His justice and His righteousness. That is what is going to exalt Him as a just and holy God. And what ultimately destroys this nation of Israel is their inability to love justice and their failure to do what is right. That's what's going to destroy Israel. They no longer cared about justice. They were greedy. If they cared about justice, they would have treated their fellow countrymen in the way that God had established for them to do in Leviticus. But we see here in this passage tonight that they don't do that. They don't follow God's way. They no longer care about God's justice. They no longer understand and do what is right. Now, Isaiah mentions God's holiness here in verse 16. And I want you to know that holiness is more than just an indication of deity. You know, quite often when we think of our holy God, we think of His deity, that He's this being that is otherworldly above all things. And there is that element to it, but the Hebrews in their language had a different understanding, a more in-depth understanding of what holiness was when they talked about God. He had revealed Himself all through Isaiah, all through Israel's history, as a moral God. He had established the law. He had given it to them. He had told them how to relate to Him. And this moral God expected His people to be a moral people. Leviticus 20:26 is quoted by Peter, and it says, God says to His people, you are to be holy because I am holy. And God didn't intend for that to mean you are to be deity, you are to be a God because I am a God. What He meant by that was, I am a God of moral character, of justice and righteousness, and because that is my character, I expect that to be your character. That is what you are supposed to be as a nation, is my chosen people. You are to be a moral people. You are to be just and upright. You know what this ultimately requires of us? If we are going to be just and upright, if we're going to be and have this character of God, it requires some self-sacrifice, some self-denial on our part. This is what Jesus taught us. When you look in Matthew chapter 22, in verse 34, the Pharisees, they come to Jesus and they come to Him with a question, thinking that they're going to catch Him, that they're going to get Him in a trap. And they ask Him this question, Teacher, which is the great commandment in the law? What is the greatest commandment that is out there? What is the greatest commandment that God has given us? And Jesus' answer is, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. Coming from the Shema in Deuteronomy 6. But Jesus didn't stop there. He says, this is the greatest and foremost commandment. And then in verse 39, He says, the second is just like it. It's exactly like the first one. Loving the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind is exactly like this second commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commandments depend the whole law and the prophets. Everything that God has written in His law represents His character, represents His nature. This God who is just, who is righteous, and who is Himself love. And Jesus says to us right here in his own teachings in Matthew chapter 22 that all of it, everything that God has given to his people, hinges on two things. Number one, you love God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. All of your being is submitted and given over to God. You don't belong to yourself. Your body doesn't belong to you. Your mind doesn't belong to you. Your soul doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the God who created and made you, who gave you life. It's his. And you are to love him with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. He comes before you, before your pleasures, before any of your desires, before any of your dreams and your hopes. His will comes first. But then you aren't second. Because if you are to be this moral character, this moral creature, as your God is a moral being, and you are to be holy as he is holy, then you have to keep his law. And the second command, which sums up everything else that God has given us, that tells us who comes second. It's God first, then it is your neighbor. You are to love your neighbor as yourself. Now, you can sit here and debate with me all day long what is meant by neighbor. But I would challenge you to show me anywhere in Scripture where it doesn't mean any other human being but yourself. You can't do it. You are to love God first. You are to love your fellow man second. And if you keep those the top two priorities, and you love the way that God has said for you to love, it means you're going to treat your fellow man justly. You're going to practice righteousness. And if you do those things, you can maintain favor with God and a right relationship with him. In verse 17, what we see happening in Isaiah chapter 5, God has laid waste these houses. He's laid to waste their fields. He has sent these people who no longer truly know him, who are unable of practicing love, who do not have the ability to practice justice, and who have failed because they have failed to do what is right. In verse 17, all of this has been laid desolate, and now we see that lambs are going to graze in those pastures, and that strangers are going to eat in the waste places of the wealthy. Flocks are going to be grazing on top of the ruins of the land. People that God never intended to enjoy all of that wealth that they had worked so hard for to accumulate for themselves, someone else is going to enjoy it because God's taken it away from them. Here's the last principle as we close tonight. God's justice and his righteousness will prevail. Period. No matter what you see going on in this world, you need to understand that God is working through history, through the turmoil and trouble that we see happening right now, in order to bring about the ultimate redemption of humanity and this fallen world. He is still working. His justice and his righteousness will prevail. Now, the last part of that principle is this. You can either experience that justice and righteousness in peace through joyful submission to him. You can know that justice and the justice and righteousness of God by experiencing it in peace through a joyful submission to him, loving him with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, loving your neighbor as you love yourself. You can know justice and righteousness that way, or you can experience it in wrath through your prideful self-exaltation. That choice is yours.